Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to talk about pundits for a good part of this program today, and the world of pundits and the truths and lies they tell. Joshua Green is a writer for The Atlantic. He's not one of the pundits I'm talking about, by the way. And author of the article Regulate Pundits, which is a promotion for their August Ideas issue that will appear on the web. Josh Green, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
So when my producer, Jessica Phillips, said, read this, Mark, this is good. It is. You're right. You can't escape pundits. They're everywhere. And let's talk about the idea. I guess you're not saying ban pundits, but you're saying regulate pundits.
Well, yeah, the context we're talking about here is The Atlantic does a special issue July and August. It's just coming on the newsstand. It's the ideas issue, and as part of this, we do every day on our website, we do an idea of the day. And my idea was, let's regulate pundits. Now, this was offered up, you know, as a slightly tongue-in-cheek idea, but I don't think it's such a bad idea. And the idea isn't to, you know, to punish anybody or ban anybody like that, at least not permanently. But if you think about all the opinion that's out there on blogs, on cable news, on Twitter, on radio, you name it, you just have this endless stream of people who are offering up their opinions. Most of them are wrong, and they're never really held to account. You know, you get the same braying jackass that was telling you to go into Iraq or to do this or to do that. You could be wrong on every major issue of the day and yet still get back, you know, invited back on Fox News, invited back on MSNBC, as though you were right, not wrong. And to me, there's something kind of insulting to the public intelligence about that. And so I thought that maybe we could kind of come up with a system to reward the better pundits and punish the worst ones.
Now, I have a feeling, though, if in your heart of hearts, that one paragraph you began that says that pesky First Amendment prevents us from silencing them outright. If you could, would you do that? Just shut them up?
Well, look, I'm not holding myself up as a shining beacon of constitutional liberties. No, there are all sorts of people on TV that I'd love for them to shut up and go away forever. And if I could turn on my TV and never see them again, I'd be the happiest guy on earth. So don't mistake me as having strictly the purest motives here, but you know, we can't do that. And so the idea I'd propose in the piece is that, well, look, if you know, the government can't regulate this, certainly the various reputable media outlets ought to be able to get together and strike some sort of a gentleman's agreement that, you know, just a commonsensical one says, you know, if you're consistently wrong when you come on here and offer your opinion, we're not going to invite you on anymore, or at least there's going to be a little time out and you're going to have to, you know, go out and maybe do some research to back up your opinions, and then maybe when we let you back on the air, you won't be wrong all the time. That was one idea. Another idea is that, you know, there are all sorts of organizations out there. Media Matters for America is a big liberal organization, and if you go to their website, you can basically see they've listed every dumb thing Bill O'Reilly and Republicans have ever said about anything. So it's not as though there aren't people out there keeping careful track of this stuff. What I'm urging in this piece is just that we act on it a little bit.
So who rankles you the most, or more consistently, I would say?
I think that, you know, a lot of the folks on Fox News who are out there, you know, banging the table to go into Iraq, who were cheering on the housing bubble, and when it turned out they were wrong, you know, they would switch on a dime and just as easily, you know, argue the opposite side of an argument. But by no means is this limited to conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, there are liberal pundits that do the same thing, but it's basically just sort of the job description that whether you're right or wrong is less or even knowledgeable is less important than that you be able to come on TV and emphatically declare X, Y, or Z, even if you don't know a damn thing about it. And that's what I think is sort of insulting to the general public's intelligence. And I think that it would be a neat idea if some of these folks were held to account in a way that maybe didn't punish them but held them up for justifiable ridicule or at least offered the public service of reminding the public, you know, that so-and-so was wrong and that and that maybe what he's saying right now isn't the smartest thing in the world, even though he'd like you to think it is.
So is there a difference for you between pundits, let's say, like, let me think here for a moment. Let's say blowhards like O'Reilly and people who are considered more establishment and thoughtful like George Will.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, you know, Will is a thoughtful guy, whether you're a liberal or a conservative.
Right.
there's some basis to his thoughts. I mean, there's some consistency in philosophy. It appears anyway more thoughtful than a lot of what O'Reilly says. But even George Will is wrong from time to time, and there's certainly nothing wrong with, you know, with letting that be known. I mean, if you used to watch, Louis Rukeyser used to have a financial show on PBS.
Yes.
Every Friday night. Right.
Right. Well, out of Maryland. Yeah.
Right. Right. And he would have as his guests a lot of fund managers, stock traders, that sort of thing. And what they would do is they would put on the screen, they would sort of disclose, you know, so and so who is doing the talking, you know, owns X, Y, and Z fund, so that you would know as a viewer if he were suddenly, you know, touting these funds, you could see if he owned them or not. And so you could sort of make your own determination. Is this guy saying this because it's true, or is he saying it because he wants the stock to go up? You could do the same sort of thing with political pundits. You know, if somebody, you know, if me, Josh Green, appeared on the screen there on Fox News and I was spouting off about this or that, there ought to be a little box there that says Josh Green was wrong about the Iraq War, he missed the housing bubble, but he did call that the Red Sox would win the 2007 World Series. You could say to yourself, oh, hey, look, the guy doesn't have any idea what he's talking about. I'm gonna take his opinion with a grain of salt. So.
I guess, you know, when I think of the liberal pundits that kind of rankle me sometimes, one who really rankles me a lot is Keith Olbermann. I don't know what I guess it's just the antics. I mean, whether it's right or left, a lot of these guys just have these antics that can just get annoying along with their monologue.
Well, it is, and it's the selfish assuredness, the ungrounded certainties of the opinions. And, you know, maybe one way to counterbalance that a little bit was if there was a ticker running along the bottom that said, you know, Keith was wrong about X, Y, and Z. it wouldn't be quite as annoying if you knew that you know, there were some consequences, or that, you know, you'd be embarrassed a little bit if you consistently made the wrong calls about things. You know, who knows, it might have a positive effect on pundits. They might sit down and think, now, do I really know what I'm talking about? And if you don't, maybe you can go out and do a little research, and the quality of the punditocracy would inch a little higher.
Now, I like this. I like that. I think there's an idea brewing here that maybe someone will take hold of. I think probably the most plausible idea you have is your suggestion that Jon Stewart and The Daily Show should do a segment.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason this has to be dull or boring or punitive or anything. The idea is just, you know, let's air both sides here. You get to hear them making their opinions, but you never really have to hear if they're wrong or not. And so one of the things I suggested was, you know, The Daily Show delights in digging up clips of stupid things politicians have said and kind of holding them up. And I consider that very much a public service. There's no reason that The Daily Show couldn't do a 5-minute segment every night on, you know, George Will or Bill O'Reilly or Keith Olbermann, you know, predicting a year ago that X, Y, or Z would happen and pointing out that, you know, gee, it hasn't. And there's enough rigor in how people keep track of these opinions, you know, again, places like Media Matters, that, you know, it'd even be possible to grade and make some sort of determination about, you know, this guy over here is the very worst pundit and this guy here is the second worst pundit. You know, and on the other hand, you know, you'd also be able to distinguish those who were fairly good, and maybe we as a viewing public could then feel confident, put a little bit of stock in their opinions.
So have you approached The Daily Show with this idea?
I have not. I'm waiting for them to come to me.
I see. So any calls?
Not yet, no. But once they hear the show, I expect they'll be rolling in any minute.
I think so, too. We'll have to make sure they get to the show immediately and know that this is an idea.
Yeah, please see to it that they do. I'd like to be involved in this.
I think I love this idea because, I mean, when I watch these things, I mean, I actually have come to a point where, even though it's my business to talk about social and cultural issues and interview people on the air, I have a hard time watching these things. I mean, I literally change the channel sometimes. I just can't. I don't even want to comment on it because I can't bear to watch it.
But wouldn't you watch it more if the guy up there bloviating, if there was a ticker running along that was sort of humiliating the guy at the same time?
I'd love that.
He got this wrong, he got that wrong. I mean, that'd be appointment viewing. You know, Washington is regulating everything else in the world these days. Maybe they could regulate this, too.
What about in this last few days? Has anything popped at you in these last few days that really has gotten to you since you've written this piece?
One of the things coming out today, you know, Obama announced his financial regulations. You know, a lot of people on Wall Street think they're too onerous. A lot of people who are anti-Wall Street think they're not nearly strict enough, and people are going out there making all sorts of kind of pounding on the table declarations about these are too strong or these aren't strong enough. You know, I'll bet if you were to look back after our next financial scandal, whatever it turns out to be, there are going to be an awful lot of people who are declaring with utter certainty today and tomorrow that, you know, X, Y, and Z thing is what's important and what's going to happen. It's going to turn out that they're going to be entirely wrong. And that's something I'd like to know about next time I see them opining on television.
I'm one of those who would love to see punditry kind of banned. I mean,
yeah, I'd be all for that. But look, even if we couldn't do that, we could have a lot of fun stopping short of that. I mean, what if they had to grovel and beg their way back onto TV before they'd be allowed out of a series of bad calls? What if they had to wear a dunce hat and kind of, you know, sit off to the side of the studio or something like that? You know, people who go on TV are willing to do just about anything in order to be on TV. And we could exploit this and have a lot of fun with it in a way that I think would be good for everybody.
So I think perhaps maybe that's an idea. Well, how about if they started a reality show to let people
even
decide?
Better.
You know,
even better.
Should we bring back the pundit? Some kind of, you know, that put their stuff up there and let the nation vote by Twitter and everything else.
Or we could just, you know, throw them off the island one by one and leave it at that. I mean, there are all sorts of possibilities.
I wonder who would actually do something like this. I think that the network chiefs would probably not want to do this.
You know, I've thought this one through. They wouldn't do it on their own. They wouldn't do it voluntarily. But to me, this has all the hallmarks of being a populist, grassroots-driven kind of idea. And I think the way to really kind of tap into that is to do it on the Internet. You know, every TV owner, every newspaper owner, every mainstream media owner is sort of quaking as the economy slips, as, you know, readers abandon old media publications and go online. If there were some kind of a concerted grassroots effort to say, we're not going to watch your dumb show unless you start doing a better job with your pundits, I think that the mainstream media would knuckle under pretty quickly to a big Internet movement. So the pressure's got to come from the bottom up, but I think it could happen.
I like that idea. I mean, if Iranian urban dwellers can do it through the media,
there you go.
You know?
Then
why can't Americans?
There you go. No reason that kind of energy and enthusiasm, you know, can't be harnessed domestically, you know, to spare us from these tyrannical pundits who are insulting our intelligence every day.
So have any of these tyrannical pundits mocked you yet for this thing that you've written?
Oh, no, not yet. But look, let's be clear here. I mean, you were very nice in kind of excusing me from this category. I don't excuse myself. I go on TV and I blather and I give my opinions the same way everybody else does. So I just want to sort of stand up and say, as a representative of the pundit class, I would certainly be willing to submit to these kind of rules. And if I go on TV and get it entirely wrong, I wouldn't expect to be invited back. So this isn't so much me casting aspersions on other people as kind of standing up for you know, the entire class of Beltway talking heads and saying, I think it's time for a change, and I'm sort of suggesting these new rules and volunteering that they apply to me too. So
no one is innocent, and I will go along with that as well. I would submit to those rules as well. Joshua Green, this has been wonderful.
Thanks so much. Always good to be with you.
And writer of The Atlantic, author of the article we're talking about, Regulate Pundits. And you can go to atlanticmagazine.com, or you can go to our website and just click on the link and go right to Joshua Green's piece. And thank you, Joshua Green.
Good to be with you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And we're going to talk in this part of our show today with Carl Frisch, who is a senior fellow for Media Matters. He's worked in politics for both Republicans and Democrats, including John McCain's 2000 presidential campaign and Howard Dean's 2004 Democratic presidential campaign. More recently, he served as press secretary for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, now a senior fellow at Media Matters. And Carl, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we just talked a minute ago to Joshua Green from Atlantic, the
yes.
Atlantic Monthly, and he wrote this tongue-in-cheek piece. I don't know if you saw it, called Regulate Pundits.
Yes.
So what do you think?
Well, I can only imagine the red tape that one would have to go through to regulate punditry. I'm kidding. It's funny when you think about, pundit regulation and whatnot, simply because, you know, it seems that with the more accountability that one holds to the punditocracy, in Washington, the more they repel from any sense of civil political discourse. So I'm not sure that it would help much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for increased accountability, especially in the wake of everything that's been happening in this country.
Well, let's talk about the accountability in a serious vein. I think that I said half-jokingly to Josh Green, and only half-jokingly, that I have an increasingly difficult time even watching television.
Right.
I mean, it's just so outrageous and so frightening in some ways. I do this for a living, so sometimes I'm forced to watch it so I can comment and talk about what people are seeing themselves. I don't know how we actually get our hands around this issue.
Well, I think the first and most important thing is that this type of stuff used to happen in the ether. So if you weren't watching, you never even knew it happened. So there was really no accountability unless you were one of the handful of people. I mean, let's remember, Fox News may brag about Bill O'Reilly's audience being over around a million people, but there's 300 million Americans out there not listening to him. You know, now that the Internet has kind of, you know, technology and the Internet have leveled the playing field, so to speak, things don't just escape into the ether anymore. Every day at MediaMatters.org, we're posting research item after research item documenting not just the crazy, venomous speech that happens out there on cable news and conservative talk radio, but also the ins and outs of mistakes by traditional publications like the New York Times, the Washington Post,
mm-hmm.
you know, outlets like CNN, the AP, NPR. Because really, when you look at the media as a whole, there's problems across the board. And the reason why monitoring and creating this backlog, this archive, this public record, if you will, of the foibles and past comments of these pundits is so important. It's because they, you know, it used to be if somebody actually faced controversy, they'd brush it off as, well, you know, this is a one-time thing. I'm so sorry. Forgive me. But now we have your history online, and we can tell you if it's been a one-time thing or if you've been doing this for months and you've only now been called on the carpet for it. And the reason why that accountability is so important is because with only a certain fraction of society actually watching these programs, there's another equally large population being affected by these programs. I call it the water cooler approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks listening to Rush Limbaugh probably won't be swayed by an argument from a progressive or from, you know, a traditional objective journalist. But they take their marching orders from Rush right to the water cooler at work and pass along the misinformation to their coworkers, their friends, their family. And without making noise over the comments that are being made, these friends, family, coworkers, et cetera, may end up believing what they're hearing because it's coming from a trusted source in their friend. But because of our abilities now to level the playing field and get this information out there, it's less likely to leave a lasting impression on the person who's unsuspecting. And that's a vital first step in holding these pundits accountable.
Carl Frisch is with us. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters of America. And we're talking to him just about pundits and what the untruths and sometimes outright lies being told in the media and how you deal with all that. I mean, I'm there are a bunch of things I wanted to ask you. One is that what you just said a moment ago about the New York Times, National Public Radio. How do they respond to you when you critique their work? Let's say NPR, New York Times, for example.
Depends on the reporter. Some reporters. It also depends on the what we're calling them out for.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we don't operate from a perception that there's some kind of a bias in the media, whether it's conservative or liberal. That would require some kind of mind reading. And try as I might, I haven't developed that sixth sense yet.
Let me know when you do. I'd like to learn it myself.
I will. I have a feeling I'd have my own television show.
But, you would.
Carl Frisch, the media whisperer or something like that. But so we can't read minds. And we also know that when you're reading a print story, and let's say that you read something and let's say it's on global warming, and they quote a global warming denier in there without noting that the person takes money from the oil and gas lobby and is on the fringes of the science community,
mm-hmm.
who all believe that global warming is real and is caused by humans. And they don't note that. Well, that's a problem. So Media Matters is going to write an item about it. But what we found is sometimes when you go to the reporter with that item, that noting that they left important information out, sometimes that reporter will say, look, I had it in there, but the editors took it out because of space.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the reporter's fault. But it's nonetheless important to point out the error. So we don't accuse these reporters of bias. We hold them to high standards of journalistic responsibility. So sometimes we'll get a response like that. Other times we'll get outright corrections, and sometimes we face, just defiant indignance on behalf of the person who's made the offense. But what we've found is over time, every time we post a research item at MediaMatters.org, we're providing people with the video or audio, if it's television or radio, along with the transcript. And if it's a print publication, we're giving you the full rundown of it. We're linking to publicly available source material to prove our point. But we're also providing users with contact information for the offending news outlet. And what we found is that even a dozen well-thought-out, well-reasoned emails to an editor have a tremendous impact. We've wrestled corrections that were 10 years in the making out of the New York Times.
Hmm.
And it wouldn't, without the people that come to our website every day that are, sending in emails, making phone calls, writing letters to the editor, very little would actually happen.
Can you give us an example of that one of those campaigns that really worked?
Sure. I think if you look at, if folks remember, just to take a flashback to 2007 or 6, I believe, when ABC Television was getting ready to air a program about 9/11 that was like a dramatized accounting of events.
Right.
That they said were all based on historical record. And Media Matters, found out that there were lots of historical problems, that a lot of it was dramatized, A Current Affair or one of those shows that reenact, horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
ABC, we started a campaign with the help of other folks in the progressive community, and ABC relented and made changes to the movie. They stopped saying that it was based wholly on historical accounts. Scholastic, which folks that remember grade school
nice,
will remember getting those magazines in their classrooms, had partnered with ABC to put classroom materials about the program, and Scholastic disassociated itself from ABC and the program as a result of the hard work. Then you've got Don Imus, who just a plethora of progressive organizations ran with one of our clips where he had likened the Rutgers women's basketball team to a bunch of nappy-headed hoes.
Oh, who can forget that?
He lost his job over it.
Right.
And then you've got countless corrections every single, week in major publications like the New York Times, whether they're, reporting, changing a story that they'd written on the Clintons in the 90s, finally, or adding additional context in their future stories about a subject. All of these things are made possible by everyday Americans who are concerned with the state of the media taking action. And what we always tell people is it doesn't matter what issue is most important to you, just as long as the second most important issue to you is the way the media covers that issue. Because at the end of the day, that's where the fight is. And there's only one side to the truth. And I happen to be of the opinion that when the truth is out there, progressives win.
And I think that I'm the whole idea of what Media Matters does. It must be sometimes profoundly satisfying for you to know that you're actually being heard, that people are listening, that you're having an effect with your work.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when I go to different cities to speak at events and whatnot, and I get to hear from people that are on our email list or visit our website every day. I had a funny moment. I had to call the IRS about fixing one of my old tax returns.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to the woman on the phone, and she, very much in the government voice, name and Social Security number, please.
Right.
Where do you now work? Can I have the address? What's the name of the company? Media Matters for America. Oh, you're kidding me. You work at Media Matters? I go to the website every day. Thank you so much. I have to tell you, I was beside myself.
That's great. That's good. Did it help you on your tax return?
No. Still had to put in an amended filing.
Oh, well. You never know what could happen.
Yeah.
Carl Frisch is joining us.
But
right
again,
now.
It was the Bush years, so.
Those are the
maybe I'll get an audit.
You never know. Carl Frisch is joining us right now, senior fellow for Media Matters, as well as contributing to County Fair. What's been going on lately with on the conservative side of the media and talk, especially the conversation being created in America about the kind of the hate speech or the speech that is that people are think are directly or indirectly related to some of the kind of fear and paranoia and violence that we're seeing?
Well, you know, since Obama announced his campaign for president, they've been stoking this culture of paranoia out there. And, you know, when you consider the violence that's happened of late, whether it's Dr. George Tiller's murder or the shooting at the National Holocaust Museum this past week, it's frightening. It's dangerous. And this is the type of rhetoric, you know, calling him a socialist, saying that he's not an American, that he was born somewhere else, and on down the conspiracy, you know, ladder to the depths where you're just a nut. This is the kind of stuff that used to happen in the 90s, but it happened way off in the fringe. You really had to dig to find it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been mainstreamed by the likes of Fox News and the Washington Times and conservative talk radio. So it's something that you hear every single day. There's a constant mantra in this country in the conservative media that Barack Obama, Democrats in Congress, and the government are out to get you. They're out to take your liberty. They're out to take your freedom. They're out to take your guns. They're out to get you. You know, you have people like Glenn Beck trafficking in a conspiracy theory that Obama was using FEMA to set up concentration camps for conservatives who disagreed with him.
Right.
And it took him 3 weeks to finally come out. He did say at the time, I don't know if this is true, but I have no evidence to disprove it. It took him weeks to correct the public record on that after he talked about it over and over and over. You know, the whole notion that Obama's coming to take your guns when there's absolutely no evidence that there's any plan in the works. In fact, there's evidence that the opposite is true.
Right.
So these types of things create an environment of fear. And, you know, it reinforces this idea that Obama's not American, which is a fringe notion. These birthers who believe that Obama was born in Kenya or some other country. All of these things play into the same paradigm that Obama is not one of us.
Right.
So, you know, I don't blame conservatives in the media for a handful of crazy people that go on shooting sprees. But they are fostering a media environment where that type of thought is only a few degrees off.
And it's that this is tied to what you were saying earlier, which is what you call the water cooler effect. To me, I mean, what's happened is this seems to me as America has become really in some ways very sharply divided and has become established and rooted now in our media. And I don't know, I'm not quite sure what one does to kind of really address that. In other words, I mean, when you talk about the New York Times or National Public Radio or some other established media, saying okay, maybe either confronting you saying I don't agree with your criticism or at least answering you back in some logical way or responding by correcting what they've done. I don't see the kind of Glenn Becks and Rush Limbaughs of the world doing that.
Well, and that's why it's so important to, you know, marginalize these characters so that those out there that aren't watching them know exactly what they're up to. You know, it should be an insult to a reporter when you say you're just like Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should be an insult to a reporter when you say, you know, why don't you go write for the Washington Times? It needs to be so ingrained in the minds of everyday people that these are not objective outlets for news, so that they won't be trusted by unsuspecting ears. I think if people go to MediaMatters.org every day, they can filter their news through us and see what's really going on out there. And we're not making this up. Like I said, we supply all the transcripts, video, audio, and publicly available source material to make our point. The only way to create the change we're looking for is to do that. And the second thing people need to do is support alternative and progressive forms of media.
I mean, when you have people in Media Matters, like your fellow senior fellow, Eric Bollert.
Yes.
When he wrote about what the Fox News and its host said, well, quote unquote, will have more right wing vigilantism to explain, end quote.
And 2 days later, we had the shooting at the Holocaust Museum.
Exactly, exactly. It's difficult to say that one led to the other, but there is this conversation going on. I mean, there's an article I read that was in Color Lines, the magazine Color Lines, about the South.
Right.
And about how 80-some percent of some states of white American voters voted against Barack Obama. And so you can't call everyone who said, okay, you vote against Barack Obama, that means you're a racist. But there is this connection. Again, it's this water cooler effect you talk about. And it's bubbling very fast and heating up. And I think a lot about how you have to respond in some ways to what's coming at you. My wife went to Indiana to visit family.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a conversation with somebody who she loves very dearly, who came back with a comment like, I would never shoot Barack Obama, but if someone did, I'd give money to their defense fund.
Yeah.
So, and what I'm saying is this is not an isolated few people in America we're talking about here.
Right. People often ask, you know, who are these people? And, you know, here's one way to look at it. When you look at polls of President Bush when he was at his most unpopular, you still had about 1 in 5 Americans who supported everything he did in every poll, disagreed with Democrats on absolutely everything, still thought Bush was doing a good job, et cetera, et cetera. So there's going to be that, you know, roughly 20% of Americans who are completely illogical in their thinking, who always toe the party line and are vehemently against progressives, against Obama, against any Democratic president or Congress, and that's going to exist. The goal for people should be to minimize their impact.
I wonder if you could describe for a minute, Carl Frisch, that and when I introduced you at the beginning of our conversation, as someone who's worked in politics for both Republicans and Democrats, John McCain in 2000 and Howard Dean in 2004.
Better to say Republicans than Democrats.
Right.
So people don't think I'm still doing, you know, everybody experiments in their youth. I've reformed and I've been on my contrition tour for about a decade.
I wasn't asking you to have contrition here with us today, but I'm curious about, if you don't mind me asking, about your that transition for you, about what happened to Carl Frisch.
Well, I started off in politics very young. I was about 18 when I was in college and had my first paid gig on a campaign.
Uh-huh.
And my politics were 110% about me. I was like that kid in your high school class who who told everybody, "I'm going to be president one day."
Mm-hmm.
The annoying guy in the front of the classroom. And, you know, I was also gay and hiding it.
Uh-huh.
And at about, oh, I don't know, 22 or 23, I had this thought in my head. Carl, what if you never get to be a congressman or a senator or president and you get a trophy wife and you never get to be happy?
Mm.
Or what if you get to be a congressman and that's it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, again, all these thoughts were about me.
Right, right, right.
Ideology was secondary to my politics. What's your ideology? you know, and then the other thought occurred in my head was, or you can be relatively happy in life, and maybe one of those things will come along to pass. And over the course of about a year after the McCain campaign in 2000, I started coming out to people, and then I switched parties.
Hmm.
Because the more I was out and open about who I was, the more I could identify with and have empathy for other people that are in marginalized communities. And slowly over time, my politics became much more about other people than it was about myself. to the point at which I have absolutely no interest in running for office anymore.
Congratulations.
And I'm more committed to a cause than I am to my own self-interest. And, you know, over time, you begin to see how that change in fundamental ideology affects your positions on various policy positions.
That's very interesting. So coming back again to Media Matters and the work you're doing now, and I'm just want to talk for a minute and your thoughts on this Democratic, the Department of Homeland Security report that came out.
Yes.
And what's been going on lately and what your take on it is all on how you've been covering all this.
Well, you know, it's funny. The report came out in April, or was declassified in April.
Right.
And it synced pretty closely with a similar report that came out in January about left-wing extremism, you know, and what to watch for and what the threat was, et cetera. So this report came out in April about right-wing extremism, and conservatives blew a gasket, saying that it was proof that Obama was coming after them, that if you had disagreed with Obama, then the Department of Homeland Security was now going to come after you, that maybe this was a way to, you know, disenfranchise those teabaggers with their little protests all over the country, which just was kind of strange. If you read the report, it talked about fringe right-wing extremists who could commit acts of domestic terrorism. And then conservatives in the media said, oh, they must be talking about us.
Mm-hmm.
What they must think of themselves to think that this report was about them. So that went on for a couple weeks, and then over time, the bodies started stacking up. You had the shooting in Pittsburgh,
right,
by a guy who trafficked in Obama conspiracy theories, thought Obama was coming to take his guns, was a huge fan of Glenn Beck, and was posting clips of Glenn Beck's show on fringe conspiracy theorist and white supremacist websites. He killed three police officers. You had the killer, you know, that murdered Dr. Tiller in Kansas. You have this that nut job in Arkansas that opened fire in the church.
Oh, right.
And was a disciple of O'Reilly, Beck, Savage, the whole lot of them, having a library full of their books, and saying that he was going after the liberals. You have the latest example here in D.C. of the shooting at the National Holocaust Museum, of a white supremacist who was anti-government to the nth degree and didn't think the conservative movement was quite conservative enough for him.
Mm-hmm.
So in this environment, it makes one ask, what about that DHS report that all these people, conservatives in the media, so quickly shunned and so quickly took out of context to attack the Obama administration? You know, it begs the question, what on earth were they thinking? To a similar extent, the rhetoric coming out of the right wing in the media has really created an environment that is not healthy or safe. In the 90s, you'd have to dig really deep to find this kind of fringe rhetoric. It was there, but you had to really dig,
right,
to find this anti-Clinton rhetoric. You'd hear about people accusing the Clintons of murder, but you wouldn't find it on talk radio too often or in the op-ed pages of newspapers or on a cable television network or on a network news network. But that kind of fringe mentality has been mainstreamed. All day long, every day, Fox News, a bit on CNN, a bit on MSNBC, all over conservative talk radio, on the nation's op-ed pages, all over the place, is a constant drumbeat of socialist, Marxist, communist. He's not one of us. He's out to get you. He's out to get your freedom. He's out to get your guns. He's out to get your liberty. Mixed in with a healthy dose of conspiracy theories that make their way to the airwaves frequently, that Obama was not somehow, you know, that Obama was not born in the United States. These birther conspiracies, that Obama's shutting down only Republican-owned Chrysler dealerships, that Obama's coming to take your guns. That is the environment in which these attacks have been happening.
And the frightening thing is, I mean, the people who are pushing it on the air are really considered mainstream talk show hosts and journalists.
Some of them are getting multi-million-dollar paychecks,
right,
from news outlets. It's not like there's a special entertainment fund or quack fund.
Right. Well, it must be something. I mean, they are getting multi-million dollar contracts.
Right. They're also getting lots of ratings, high
right.
ratings. which only proves that there's an audience for just about any kind of BS out there.
So I wonder as we kind of conclude.
You know, a frightened audience is a captive audience.
Well, I was going to say that. I mean, I was about to go to the closing line of the piece you had the other day. That after all, a frightened audience is a captive audience.
It's true.
And where you think that takes us? What is that? What do you think is going to take? Now, I ask you to be prescient, but I'm just curious about all you're looking at this, and you're looking at unearthing the untruths that come out of a lot of the conservative media, and how it ends up being taken as fact and used as fact.
Where do we go from here?
Yeah,
I think we're likely to see more, if not worse, from the right, and I think you're likely to see average Americans as well as progressive Americans really standing up against it. You know, at this point, I don't think it's a matter of when the next right-wing extremist attack is going to happen, or if, rather. I think it's a matter of when. And, you know, if I was one of these guys spouting off all this garbage and then some loon out there took what I'd been saying and used it as justification to go out and kill somebody, it would seriously make me second-guess my approach.
Carl Frisch, I deeply appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Senior fellow for Media Matters, and we look forward to having you back on for an occasional conversation to keep us abreast of what's going on out there.
Anytime.
Appreciate it so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good to have you. We're about to take a short break and come right back. And when we come back, we're going to hear from David Alan Harris, a dance music therapist who specializes in fostering recovery among survivors of egregious human rights abuse. He's pioneered the use of dance and movement therapy with child soldiers. He's going to tell us the story of working with child soldiers from Sierra Leone. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with David Alan Harris, who's a dance movement therapist, specializes in fostering recovery among survivors of human rights abuses around the world. And he's a contributor to Foreign Policy and Focus, which is where we discovered his work. And David, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
This is an amazing story. You went to Sierra Leone. And to talk a bit about what took you to Sierra Leone first, so it could set our listeners up to just how you got there and why you were working with the Center for Victims of Torture.
Okay. The Center for Victims of Torture is actually a nonprofit organization or an NGO that's based in Minneapolis in the U.S. and has a number of international programs. They developed a program. I guess their first international program was in Guinea in refugee camps, which is just over the border to where I ended up in 2005 and 2006 in a remote corner of Sierra Leone. And they hired me to go there, and my job, my title was called clinician/trainer. So I was in charge of training 24 local Sierra Leoneans with secondary school education to be trauma therapists, or actually we call them psychosocial counselors,
mm-hmm.
with folks in the area, an area that had been so devastated in the war that almost everyone could be determined to be a survivor of torture or very extreme trauma of war.
Can you just for a moment, just for our listeners, describe what war we're talking about?
Sure. The war in Sierra Leone began in 1991, and it began just a few miles from where I ended up working. And it was a very brutal war. You would call it a civil war. It started out as a kind of rebellion against corruption in the government, which was a very real thing, and there was serious oppression against the people, but it evolved in very strange ways, such that the Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, that really started the war. Various factions took part in it. They began to be sort of mercenary in their practices, and they preyed on individual communities and civilians, not just, they didn't just fight against the army of the government or the other army that was involved. So it was a very brutal war, known for its severe atrocities against civilian populations, and also known worldwide, I would say, for the use of child soldiers, many recruited as young as 5 or 6 years old. The war came to an end in 2001 after intervention by international forces, actually.
And I mean, you write that there could be as many as 1 million children on the planet who are or have been child soldiers.
Yeah, it's very, very hard to know because of the efforts that fighting forces make to keep their child soldiers hidden and to keep that information. You know, there's a lot of interest, especially in the last dozen years, in learning more about fighting forces and the way that they're recruiting and trying to stop that. So at any given time, we expect that there are maybe 250,000 children serving in fighting forces around the world.
And after the war in Sierra Leone, as you write, there were at least 48,000 or more than 48,000 child soldiers, one demobilized and back into the streets, so to speak, into the communities, and one quarter of these children were girls.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't work with girls who had been soldiers, or at least the girls I worked with didn't acknowledge any participation in armed conflict. But there is, it's one of the hidden factors of this particular scourge around the world that many girls are inducted into armed forces, and of course some of them are forced into sexual servitude. Less often, perhaps, into, carrying AK-47s, but just as much devastated by the kind of horrific things that they're being forced to participate in.
Let's talk about the kids that you worked with. Talk a bit about your work as a dance therapist. I mean, I think, we often... Many people hear this word dance or movement therapy.
Yeah.
And the immediate reaction of some people is that you say dance therapy and it's some kind of fringy, not realistic thing, that to really touch people's problems and help people turn their lives around. But this is – let's start with that, and then I want to kind of rapidly move into these young kids who you worked with, the orphan boys of Kwandu. So you're a dance therapist.
That's right.
And just talk a bit about what that means.
Okay, sure. Well, dance movement therapy, as the American Dance Therapy Association defines it, which is an organization that's been around since the 60s, it's the psychotherapeutic use of movement as a process that furthers the emotional, cognitive, social, and physical integration of the individual, or in fact of the group. And my work, I know that there's this image that it's a kind of flighty thing,
Right.
But in my work with teenagers who had been soldiers and had all of them committed atrocities by the age of 13, I assure you it was anything but. It can be really gritty, just as, you think about dancing that, has evolved from Africa, and the kind of intensity of it. That's the kind of thing that you need to visualize when you're seeing us dancing together. And for one thing, it was 12 adolescent males and 3 African males all of the Kissi tribe from the region of Sierra Leone where I worked, and me, and I'm a white American.
Mm-hmm.
And so we joined together, and we would start out our day, our dancing. We had some sort of activities for getting to know one another that we started early on, and I can describe those if you like later. But we would start out with all of us in a circle, and that comes from two sources. One is that, you know, the typical African ceremony and takes place in a circle. And in addition, perhaps as an outgrowth of that, dance therapy from the work of a woman named Marion Chase, who worked in D.C. at St. Elizabeth's Hospital with primarily with veterans of World War II in the 40s, developed what she called the circle form that we call now the Chasean circle after her. And so I had the notion of fusing these things together. And we would start out with one person leading some kind of movement, rhythmic movement, to the music that these guys liked, which was a sort of Sierra Leonean hip-hop. And although there was no electricity in the area we were, we did have a boombox with batteries.
With batteries, yeah.
Yeah. And so we would play this hip-hop, and somebody would start moving, you know, gesturing to the rhythm of the music, and everybody would join in the same rhythm and create a kind of what we call movement synchrony, or being together as one in the movement. And then it would evolve, and one after another person would sort of take leadership in a kind of free-flowing way, so that there was this enormous energy that developed, and along with it, a connection. And everybody was connecting with one another in a very kind of, you know, intense, visceral way. And it's exactly the kind of thing that people who've been through atrocities tend to lose the capacity to do. They don't, you know, typically somebody who, you know, we would call traumatized isn't able to connect with other people in a kind of vital way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this step-by-step evolved in a way that these guys began to trust in one another and to trust in us, and that was fundamental to the kind of development that we were able to make.
We're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back for the next hour, David Alan Harris will continue his story of how he used dance to help child soldiers recover from trauma and the terrorizing experiences they suffered. Stay with us.